So, just as a preface, I was inspired to create this talk and give this talk in part because of a recent course that I had taken on dependent origination, which really, I think, deepened my understanding of the concept, along with its relationship to the aggregate. So, I will be presenting several different ideas within the realm of the aggregates and dependent origination. And I hope that it is as valuable to all of you as it was for me. So the talk will, however, primarily focus on the aggregates, and there is a lot that I will be weaving in when it comes to dependent origination. But when it comes to the aggregates, they are, in Pali, the term is khandas, and it is translated often as heap or group or cluster, but we know them as aggregates. And these aggregates are components of reality that make up our entire experience. And they're divided into five categories, hence the five aggregates. They represent everything that we can cling to, also hence why they are called the five clinging aggregates. And upon first impression, one might infer that the aggregates are static or enduring components of reality. But in reality, these aggregates are in themselves processes. They're always in flux. I know, at least for me, when I hear the word aggregate, especially when I hear the related translations as heap or group or cluster, it seems to maybe denote some solidity or some static nature. But they are really processes. And these aggregates that make up our experience are impersonal. They arise due to the presence of conditions and they fall away in the absence of conditions. This rising and passing away of causes and conditions is symbolic of the process of dependent origination, which I will cover more of later in the talk. The first aggregate is that of material form, which in Pali is called rupa. Rupa is comprised of four primary elements and 23 secondary elements. The four primary elements are earth, water, wind, and fire. I'm not going to go and list all 23 secondary elements, but what's important to note is that all secondary elements are dependent upon and originate from these four primary elements. But for some examples, just to give you an idea, some secondary elements include the five sense organs, like eyes, ears, nose, and the four sense objects. So anything that is visible, anything that can be heard, smelled, or tasted. So rupa basically comprises the entirety of the physical material world. There are many examples we can think of that showcase how we cling to the material world. The most common example of what we tend to cling to is the body. Clinging arises when one identifies their physical body as my or mine. We commonly say, this is my body, these are my hands, my feet, my nose, my ears, which implies a sense of self that is embedded in the body. But apart from one's body, we also commonly cling to other physical forms, whether they are material objects or other beings. We often develop attachments to sentimental objects, family members, friends, partners, pets. One can gauge their attachments to physical forms by noticing the fear of loss that might arise with respect to any one of these forms. if I'm afraid to let go of some sentimental object, or if I fear losing a loved one, then I might infer that clinging is present. The takeaway from Rupa is that we cling to material form because of the underlying premise of possession, which emerges from an illusion of self. To say or think, this is my car, or this is my friend, or this is my partner, implies, even if unintended, a sense of possession, which arises from the notion that there is a fixed autonomous self that can lay claim to any physical form in one's life. It is certainly easier said than done to renounce or relinquish clinging when it comes to some of these forms, especially when they are, say, very sentimental objects in our possession, or even more so when it comes to loved ones. And while it may not be feasible to simply notice, ah, yes, I'm attached to my family members, and suddenly craving evaporates, simply bringing awareness to the clinging that may be present, or the attachment, can subtly over time chip away at the clinging nature. And that is ultimately a wholesome outcome or consequence when one can have or continue to have these relationships with others or objects without an underlying attachment or clinging that is present. So that's the first aggregate, that of physical form. The second aggregate, that of feeling, or in Pali, Vedana, is less concrete than Rupa, although it is commonly also a form in which clinging can arise. Feeling in this regard isn't referring to the range of emotions we can experience. It refers instead to the underlying affective charge of any given state that we're in. The three feeling states we can be in at any given moment are pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Feeling is always present in our experience. So, as I just mentioned, at any given moment, we can be feeling either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. You can imagine that it's pretty straightforward how we might cling to feeling. We experience a pleasant feeling state and we want to hold on to it, or we experience an unpleasant feeling state and we try to push it away. Or maybe we experience a neutral state and we find ourselves grasping for a pleasant state because we want to feel good. Clinging to feeling states is interesting as well because the effect of both clinging and aversion inevitably and ironically leads to unpleasant feeling states or suffering. And it's ironic because the act of clinging to pleasant feelings is often the condition itself that ends up supporting the development of unpleasant feelings. And the more we resist unpleasant states, the longer we actually prolong remaining in those unpleasant states. So clinging and aversion are conditions for unpleasant feeling states to either arise or for them to be maintained. Apart from the dynamics of clinging and aversion, we can also see how the concept of self also plays a role in this process of facilitating clinging. If I feel good, I want more of this, and if I feel bad, I want less of this. To say I feel good or I feel bad lays a subtle claim or possession to the feeling state arising. But who is feeling good and who is feeling bad? There is no one there. There is just feeling pleasant, feeling unpleasant, and feeling neutral that arises and passes away. It is a river of changing affective states, and when we're caught up in self-concept, We are a person on a boat trying to exert control over the river underneath, when in reality, we are the river itself. There is no person, there is no boat. We have always just been the river. It was Vedana. We are at any given moment feeling pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. That is continuously changing based on the underlying flow of shifting causes and conditions. Clinging and aversion to feeling states are conditions that have the paradoxical opposite effect that these hindrances are intended to have. And the core illusory sense of self underlying and facilitating this arising of clinging and aversion ultimately is what leads to that sense of constriction and perpetuates suffering. So with Rupa and Vedana so far, we have seen a common thread that clinging and aversion may play, but also primarily the role of non-self and how non-self, or how the role of the illusion of self, I'm sorry, gives rise or perpetuates that propensity to clinging and aversion. And so I just want to make a point to acknowledge this role of the illusion of self and how intrinsic in both of these aggregates so far is this element of non-self. The next aggregate is perception, which in Pali translates to sanya. Perception refers to the process of recognizing and naming objects. We use the function of perception when we look at a tree and recognize it as a tree, or when we feel an emotion and label it as angry or happy. So perception, in a way, refers to the process of recognizing all of the concepts we form about our inner and outer world. Our language is a tool to communicate our experience, but when we cling to the concepts communicated through language, we end up limiting ourselves in the process. There was a Dharma talk that I listened to by Joseph Goldstein a while back that I think gave an example of this limiting aspect of perception or concepts quite well. And he described a story in which maybe a second grader was in class, and the teacher asked the kids, you know, what are some colors of apples? And so people were, you know, raising their hands. Kids were saying, like, you know, red, yellow, green. And one kid raised his hand and said white. And so the teacher was like, no, no, there are no white apples. And the child insisted that there were white apples. And so they have this back and forth. They're kind of debating about this. And then eventually the kid says that when you cut into an apple, it's white. And so it was a very, I think, perfect example of how this child was able to be or answer this question in a way that was not limited by the concept of what apples are supposed to look like, because he thought of it from a different lens of what they look like on the inside. And the teacher was stuck in the concept of an apple's color having to be exclusive to the exterior of the apple. Her perception was in some way quite limited, and the student's perception remained open to the question of what apples are, and very creatively just noted that apples can also be white just on the inside. We can also see how the adherence to concepts also limits our perception of emotions and feeling states. For example, say that my heart is racing right before I'm about to give a speech in front of a large auditorium, and I feel jolts of adrenaline along with sweaty palms or restlessness. I would perceive these sensations and come up with the label of anxiety or fear. But if we examine just the bare bones of the sensations that led me to come up with the anxiety label, we might see that the same sensations we use to label anxiety can also be applied to excitement. Anxiety and excitement use the same neurobiological pathways in the body. So physiologically, they are indistinguishable. But because my perception recognized the sensations and labeled it as anxiety, my experience thereafter would look quite different than if I'd labeled it as excitement. When I label it as anxiety, what is most likely to happen? My concept of anxiety is associated as an unpleasant feeling. So the moment I labeled the sensations as anxiety, I would have then and there created the conditions for an unpleasant feeling state to arise. My thoughts thereafter might look like, oh no, I'm feeling anxious. I don't like this. I don't want to feel anxious. And now aversion is present along with the unpleasant feeling state. And we learned in the previous aggregate that aversion or pushing away of states prolongs them or sustains them. So by labeling the sensations as anxiety, I effectively created the conditions for an unpleasant feeling state, and as a result, aversion arose, and I would then linger in that unpleasant state for longer. But what would have happened if I initially labeled the sensations as excitement? My concept of excitement is associated as a pleasant feeling. So the moment I label it as excitement, I create the condition for a pleasant feeling state to arise. My whole experience thereafter has a more positive charge to it, as opposed to the negative charge associated with anxiety. So from these examples, we can see how perception can limit us within concepts. And when we become limited in a concept, it limits our experience thereafter. If I limit my interpretation to a set of sensations as anxiety, we can see how I would confine myself to an unpleasant feeling state. But if my perception was less rigid, I might have the flexibility to recognize the sensations as excitement, which would, as we said, produce a very different experience, one that may even be more supportive and conducive for giving an awesome speech. The main point that I want to highlight with perception, though, is that ultimately all concepts are limiting. Because whether I label the set of sensations as anxiety or excitement, those are both just conceptual interpretations of the direct experience of those sensations. What might happen if instead of trying to jump in and label those sensations as this or that, I simply observe them? What if I just stayed with the direct experience of the sensations? I might notice that the sensations are just a part of the stream of sensations that are constantly happening. So, in summary, with perception, it is the naming or the labeling of concepts, and we have names and labels for pretty much anything, both inner and outer. And there is a limiting quality to them, which can narrow our perception and also lead to some constricting consequences as a result. And so with the first three aggregates, that of form, feelings, and perception, we can see that it is an ongoing flux. Perception is always in flux, form is always in flux, and so are feelings. And so with that, it becomes clear how emptiness is playing a role, in that there is no inherent independent quality, or say enduring or stable quality to any one of these aggregates. They are interdependent with every other aggregate or aspect of experience, and therefore embody this inherent emptiness. And we see the same with the fourth aggregate, which is mental formations, of which the Pali term is sankhara. This aggregate refers to all of the mental factors which arise in different combination in every moment of consciousness. But what are mental factors? The Pali word for mental factors is chittapika, which means belonging to the mind. They are the building blocks of all mental activity, thoughts, moods, emotions, mind states, and they are delineated into four different categories. There are the universal factors, occasional factors, 14 unwholesome factors, and 25 beautiful factors. Whenever we identify with any of these factors of mind, we are reinforcing both the concept and the felt sense of self. These factors simply arise from conditions and then fall away. So, for example, some of the universal factors are contact, feeling, or perception. Some of the occasional factors are effort, rapture, and investigation. And all of these factors, inclusive of the other 14 unwholesome factors and 25 beautiful factors, only arise because of causes and conditions and fall away with the cessation of causes and conditions. So when we experience love, for example, there is a mental factor of love happening. When we experience restlessness, there is a mental factor of restlessness happening, but there's no self behind them. Love happens, restlessness happens, and then they pass away. These factors arise due to these conditions supporting their manifestation, and they pass away when they cease to be. Within this aggregate of mental formations, one mental factor stands out among the rest, and that is volition, which is synonymous with intention. It's the quality of mind concerned with the actualization of a goal. It conditions all other factors to achieve a purpose, and it's because of this ability to condition all other factors that it stands out amongst the other mental factors. Volition is common to every moment of consciousness, and any action taken within any given moment is derived from volition. So in some sense, volition is the driving force of karma. Volition or intention conditions the mind and results in action, and then our actions lead to karmic effects. We can see subtle differences in karmic effects based on the nature of the intention that precedes the action. For example, if I approach someone and say, "How was your day?" But the intention that drove me to ask, "How was your day?" was rooted in the hopes that this person would reciprocate and ask how my day was going so that I can rant all about how my day was. You can see how that would produce a very different karmic effect than if I were to approach asking, "How was your day?" from a place of genuine interest and curiosity. So volition matters. Even if the action of asking how was your day is identical in various scenarios, the volition behind the action produces very different karmic effects. It's also important to practice mindfulness of intention so that we don't identify as a self behind the intention. In the how was your day example, asking that question in the hopes that it's reciprocated implies self-absorption. So in other words, I want to ask this question so that I can talk all about my day, so I can receive attention, because receiving attention feels good. So it can be seen how that intention is intrinsically woven into a false sense of self, and why it would therefore have different karmic effects. Or in a similar vein, if I ask how was your day with the intention of being a kind person, because that's a kind thing to do and I'm a kind person, we could also see how intrinsic within that intention is a self-concept. Both the scenarios of asking how was your day, whether from a place of wanting attention or from wanting to be a kind person, both are self-absorbed. So it's important to practice mindfulness of volition, to notice whether volitions are self-absorbed. Is this intention rooted in self or non-self? Is this intention rooted in greed, aversion, or delusion, or generosity, ethical conduct, or wisdom? With the last aggregate, so we just covered mental formations. The last aggregate is consciousness, which translates in Pali into vijnana. Vijnana is the cognizing power of the mind. It is the aspect of mind that embodies the knowing faculty. Consciousness is divided by the senses. So there is eye consciousness, ear consciousness, nose consciousness, etc., etc. The quality of knowing is the same for each of these sense organs. Consciousness may be colored by different mental factors in different moments, but the knowing faculty functions in the same way regardless of what's arising. So consciousness is the bare bone experience of knowing, yet consciousness is also impersonal. It arises out of certain conditions. Seeing consciousness needs four conditions for it to arise. It needs the organ of the eye, a visible object, light, and attention. If any one of these four conditions is not present, seeing consciousness will not manifest. So just with that example, we can see how it is inherently impersonal because it arises out of certain conditions being met. There's no person who possesses consciousness. Consciousness emerges only because of the right conditions being met and likewise disappears when those conditions fall away. And while consciousness appears to be the steady state of knowing, in reality, it is continuously arising and passing away moment after moment. We experience it as a steady, continuous state, but it's only because of how incredibly fast the arising and passing away of consciousness is within each second. According to the Abhidhamma, the lifespan of consciousness, which is referred to as a mind moment, is said to occur billions of times within the blink of an eye. It's very fast. So we can see how even consciousness, which appears to have more of a permanency than the other aggregates, is itself a process that continuously arises and passes away as a result of certain conditions being present. Altogether, with these five aggregates, when we see how consciousness, along with these other aggregates of form, feeling, perception, and mental formation, individually arise because of underlying causes and conditions, we can more clearly arrive at this insight of non-self. These impersonal aggregates coalesce and support the illusion of an autonomous self within the matrix of these coalescing aggregates, which is always in flux. There's a famous painting that I think can illustrate this, and this is where I'm going to share my screen. Okay, can we all see this?
Yep.
Yes.
Okay, wonderful. It's a pretty famous one. I'm sure maybe you might have seen it at some point. If not, it's by a famous artist, I can't really pronounce his name, Georges Seurat.
Seurat.
Seurat, okay, thank you. And I think that this painting in some way is a really good example of what we're trying to convey here when it comes to the aggregates and the matrix of, one second. Are you able to still see the painting?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I just have to go back to my notes. Okay. So if we take a look at this painting, we might see that it looks coherent, it looks cohesive. But if we were to really zoom in on the painting, we might see that it is comprised of all of these different dots. It's a specific type of art called pointillism or something like that. Yeah, like superior. Yeah, you get what I'm trying to convey here. Okay. This, I think, can really embody the aggregates and how they come together to form an illusion of maybe cohesion or wholeness or an autonomous self. We have, let's say, the components of the dots. We have the components of the canvas. We have the component of the paint and the paintbrush. And all of these come together to form this painting. But when we really zoom in, as I said before, we see that these are all just a bunch of dots constructed in such a way to give the appearance of a scene and of people. And that is how these aggregates come together. So one aggregate being, right, the dots, the paint, the canvas, the brush. And that is this coalescing of this matrix of aggregates to create what appears to be cohesion or form, or rather not physical form, but rather the, say, form of self. There is a different painting that conveys the same concept. I'm gonna stop sharing it and reshare my screen. Hang on tight 1 second, but it's a very similar idea. Okay, very similar. And so this is Van Gogh, and while it is a variation of pointillism, these aren't exactly dots as it was with the last painting. These are dots with like a little bit more of a brush stroke, but still it's the same concept. Van Gogh took a bunch of these dots, put them together, and it looks like there's a person there. But it's just a bunch of dots. And those dots interact or are supported by the canvas. They were placed there by the paintbrush, and they were transmitted onto the canvas with paint. So I hope that this illustrates, no pun intended, the matrix of the aggregates and how they come together in this way to produce something that would really appear to be a solid entity when, upon closer inspection, it is merely a composition of multiple parts that come together. I've mentioned a number of times throughout this talk how the emergence of each of these aggregates does so only because of causes and conditions that support their manifestation. This river of changing causes and conditions, which embeds our every moment, is what gives rise to these aggregates as well as to their cessation. And this is, in a nutshell, dependent origination, the coming together and falling apart of causes and conditions. This river of dependent origination not only facilitates the rise and fall of each individual aggregate, but it also facilitates the coalescing of all of the aggregates that make up our moment-to-moment experience. So think of each aggregate as its own river. Each river is comprised of water, and that water cannot exist if it were not for the causes and conditions that supported its existence. If it were too hot, for example, the water would evaporate and there would be no more river. The component of water in the river is parallel to an aggregate in a constant flow, but also dependent on other variables for it to exist. The flow of the water itself, the flow which is what defines it as a river as opposed to a pool of water, is the engine of dependent origination. So now you take each individual river, each aggregate, which are fueled by dependent origination, the flow of the stream. And then you imagine all five of these rivers dancing and weaving with each other in this broader process of dependent origination. And this is what makes up our moment-to-moment reality. The coalescing of all five rivers, physical form, feeling, perception, mental formation, and consciousness creates all of the conditions for one to think that there is an autonomous self within this interdependent matrix of rivers, and yet there is no one to be found. When one sees, upon closer inspection, how the emergence of a sense of self is supported by a collage of impersonal aggregates, which are in a continuous flow of change. So how do we take all of this, which it's a lot of information, and there's, I'm sure, even more depth and nuance to each of these, but how do we take what's been presented today and apply this to daily life? By gaining insight into the aggregates, how they coalesce, and how their flow of coalescing is fueled by dependent origination, we can develop a clearer insight into the non-self and the impersonal nature of whatever emerges or ceases to be. Obtaining insight into non-self can create the condition for non-judgmentalness, compassion, and acceptance to arise. If, for example, I'm feeling angry in a given moment, and I judge the anger for being there, imposing a should, like, I shouldn't feel this way, I might recall that if anger has emerged within me, it is only because certain causes and conditions led to its emergence. Maybe I haven't eaten, I was stuck in traffic, whatever it might be. But to impose shoulds or shouldn'ts on oneself, others, or the world implies judgment or aversion towards aspects of life which are only present because of the causes and conditions that preceded its manifestation. In other words, if something is showing up within me, within others, or in the world, it is in some way meant to be there. If we understand the invisible river of causes and conditions that preceded the emergence of whatever object we're saying shouldn't be there. There's a saying, I don't know if it's like a quote that comes from somewhere, but it's kind of like, wherever you are is exactly where you're supposed to be. And I think that saying is emblematic of what I'm trying to convey here, that wherever we are is exactly where we're supposed to be precisely because of the causes and conditions that necessarily preceded and led to wherever I am in this moment, and then likewise where everyone else is and where the world is. So in the moment that I recognize that it's not a question of whether the anger that arose in me should or shouldn't be there, it is there, and it feels unpleasant, so I might offer myself some loving kindness and compassion. If a loved one of mine is behaving, say, in a rude or disrespectful way, as opposed to taking it personally and thinking to myself that they shouldn't be like that, I might recognize that the disrespectful behavior is an outcome of their own particular river, and I might feel compassion for them because I understand that the roots of disrespectful behavior are unwholesome qualities, which create suffering for them. Now, that doesn't mean that I'm not entitled to set boundaries with this person. That's a whole other topic. But the underlying message is understanding that whatever is arising in another person that we may take personally and maybe impose that they should or shouldn't be that way is negating this deeper insight that whatever is showing up in them is a direct result of whatever river of causes and conditions preceded it before. So compassion, non-judgmentalness, and acceptance are byproducts of understanding these coalescing rivers. And it's a really beautiful example of how developing wisdom can lead to profound shifts in one's perspective, which then foster these wholesome qualities to emerge. And it's through the emergence of these wholesome qualities that wholesome thoughts, feelings, and actions emerge effortlessly as we interact with ourselves and the world. Thank you. That concludes the talk for today. A lot of information. Thank you all. We only have around 15 minutes, maybe a little bit less. For any questions or comments, I apologize that we maybe don't have enough time for a more prolonged discussion, but I am happy to hear anybody's reactions or comments or questions.
Well, just a second. Marty, do you want to state your concern, or you want me to
So,
read it off?
whoops.
you can just read it. That was my reaction to some of the stuff that was said.
Oh, let me see.
Somebody read
I
it.
see what you're saying.
Yeah, Allie's reading it. And read it, please read it out loud for the
You want me
first
to read it
time.
out loud? Sure. So Marty is presenting a valid point. She's saying that she's not sure if she can agree with the anxiety versus excitement labeling as a true reflection of someone's personal experience. It sounds overly optimistic and simplistic. When someone is suffering from anxiety or panic attacks, that emotional state is very real. To say all the soldier would have to do is change the label of the experience. A soldier in a war zone experiences the realities of war. That is real. It sounds like all a soldier would have to do is label the machine gun sounds and IEDs blowing off people's arms and limbs as a firework and a celebration, and maybe they won't come home with PTSD. So this is a good point, and I appreciate Marty that you bringing in this insight and this perspective. So context does matter, of course, when it comes to labeling these or relabeling these sensations. And while it may be true that on a neurobiological or neurophysiological level, they are the same pathways, it is a state of arousal, of nervous system arousal. However, context matters and it's important. So, as Marty mentioned, the experience of being in a war, being a soldier, it would be in some ways counterintuitive potentially to label the fear or anxiety that might be coming up as excitement because it is antithetical perhaps to the context of what is happening. It's not an exciting situation to be in war. There are maybe alternative, less say straightforward situations where one can perhaps reframe or relabel those sensations as excitement in a way which it can be conducive or supportive. So the example that I gave with the speech, for example, is maybe a more nebulous situation in which labeling it as excitement can support my ability to actually give the speech. If I say, oh my goodness, I'm jittery, not because I'm nervous, because I'm really excited. This is a great opportunity. I don't know when I'm going to be able to give a speech like this in front of other people again, then it may be helpful. But anxiety and panic attacks and certain situations that are certainly harmful or very that are like ripe with suffering or abuse or war are certainly situations in which it would be unskillful to relabel those sensations as excitement. And so this points to I think what Marty's implying here is a level of discernment is needed when it comes to this process of relabeling concepts. In some situations, it may be skillful, in others, it may not. So I appreciate you bringing that in, Marty. I hope that may address it.
Yeah, Ali, can I add to that? They are actually training combat troops how to be mindful in the way that's described. It's just sound, et cetera, et cetera. They're also using mindfulness meditation as one of the ways to address people who have post-traumatic stress disorder from any kind of stress situation, automobile accident, whatever, as well as combat. What's being ignored in terms of combat is the antisocial aspects of war. We're social animals. One of the most important foundational principles of Buddhism is right speech, right action, and right livelihood, the intention to do no harm, because that creates stress in a person and it creates interpersonal stress. And that's not conducive to overcoming dukkha. So that's it's just a kind of a sidebar to what you were saying. By the way, this is the best, most complete Dharma talk you've given so far, Allie.
Thank you.
Done.
I appreciate that.
I'm so impressed.
Yeah. Brandon here in the room has a question.
And it just so happens that it's actually on the same topic, and it is from experience. I don't have a lot of Buddhist vocabulary to come from with this, but when I actually discovered, I worked in a stressful environment, when I actually discovered that I could actually just sit and experience the feeling of anxiety without allowing it to be exacerbated by the thoughts associated with it, that's when I realized that it was subjective to a certain degree. And that if you allow the thoughts, basically, I used to tell my coworkers, you're running, stop running from the tiger and run towards candy. I was being funny. And I'm trying to say this really fast, but in a war situation, there's a big difference between a scared kid and, I don't know, make up something, a samurai warrior. They're not going to respond to that environment in the same way. And they are probably going to have some mindfulness training. My question is, since all of this is dependent, is there a way to work in a stressful environment without that energy arising?
That's a really great question. And it would, I imagine, depend on what conditions have been strengthened in anticipation of, say, entering that particular stressful work environment. So it is not, say, guaranteed or set in stone that one enters a stressful situation and necessarily has to experience a very heightened level of anxiety. Of course, it depends, but we have an ability and potential to strengthen, say, qualities of mindfulness, of roundedness as a result, maybe, of mindfulness practice. And through the fostering of these qualities of mindfulness, one may be able to, say, create a buffer in which they may enter that stressful situation, and the emergence of that anxiety or stress may not take form or take or emerge, or if it does, it is maybe less so than prior. So all of this, I think, is a consequence of fostering or cultivating the qualities or conditions that would support the cessation or lack of emergence of anxiety in those situations. Does that make sense?
Sure.
Did you hear his response, Allie?
I think he said sure.
Yes.
Okay. But I mean, it's important to keep in mind as well that we have this capacity, right, to foster and cultivate these qualities of mind and mindfulness, but there's so many factors that we are just not privy to or aware of. You know, the hormones that are going through your body in that particular day, whether you've eaten, whether you've gotten enough sleep, whether some unexpected thing occurs in that workplace setting, all of these are also conditioning factors that may have the potential to elicit some stress or anxiety. And so I don't think that it may be feasible to say that one can inoculate oneself forever from potentially experiencing stress or anxiety, but we can cultivate these qualities to the best of our ability in order to, say, proactively prevent the likelihood of these things arising, or if they do, with less intensity.
Can I add a little anecdote to that, Allie?
Sure.
Jack Kornfield was a monk in Thailand, and he was a student of Ajahn Chah, a very well-respected teacher. And they were traveling through the mountains in a taxi, and the taxi driver was very reckless, passing on blind curves and on these steep slopes where there are no guardrails. If they went off the road, they tumbled down 100, 200 feet. In the middle of the ride, Jack looked at John Cha, and he had a strong grip on the back of the front seat, and his skin color had changed radically. And Jack was assuming that, oh, I must be a big failure because, you know, I'm supposed to have equanimity. And they got to their destination, and Jack looked at Ajahn Chah, and Ajahn Chah looked at him and said, oh, that was interesting, wasn't it? So my assumption is that, yeah, his adrenaline system was pumping, Ajahn Chah. It was just a condition of the moment. It's what a body does when there's mortal peril. But his mind was really at peace and clear.
It's a wonderful example.
But most people don't come, most people don't get prepared that way, though. They come back with those conditions, yeah. Right? So it's like, I mean, you can try to teach those people that they have to do mindfulness to try to help with their PTSD or their anxiety or whatever, but you know, it's real, it's present, and just saying, okay, we'll think of it in another way, is that supposed to make it better?
No, that by itself doesn't.
It doesn't.
It's sitting with the urgency and be able to recognize the urgency as just a feeling. That's what this, the story I gave about Ajahn Chah is analogous to what it's like for someone to be in any kind of perilous situation. This one had nothing to do with combat. But in a combat situation, they started doing more and more research about what was called combat fatigue in World War II. Eventually became post-traumatic stress disorder after the Vietnam War. And one of the things they discovered was that people might have been in the very same firefight, but those who had a feeling of interpersonal confidence and security, they trusted other people, could confide in other people beneficially, they walked away from it with no PTSD. The people whose previous experience in life had led them to believe that you cannot trust a person with your feelings, you cannot tell somebody what it's really like for you, it will get worse if you do that, they're the ones who are most prone to PTSD. So a lot of it has to do with the kind of interpersonal conditioning, sankhara, that we have to cope with from our childhood.
I've worked with people that train the dogs for the PTSD people to help them with their panic attacks and stuff.
Yeah, panic attacks and PTSD, I mean, these are real disorders, and they can be very complex to treat, especially PTSD, because of how trauma is really stored in the body. And so I hear what you're saying, Marty, and it is an important perspective to bring in, that it's not as simple as, say, reframing. I think that reframing is an ingredient that can go into treating PTSD or panic disorders, but it is not the full scope of treatment. One has to really approach it in a myriad of different ways and in a trauma-informed way. I think that mindfulness and this practice of reframing, say in the aftermath, can be useful, but it is not the whole picture. And as we said before, right, like there are certain situations where it can be more skillful to reframe in the moment if one is feeling anxious, and others where it is unskillful because the presence of fear is also data. It may tell one that there is potential danger. So if you're walking, say in a dark, I don't know, alleyway, you're taking a shortcut to get home and you feel fear, it might be important to acknowledge that as fear in the moment and listen to that and take a different route, as opposed to just saying, oh, I'm just so excited, you know? So the point of that example was really to just give another example of how concepts can be limiting and they can be reframed, but that doesn't mean that it would be skillful to do so in every situation. It does require a level of discernment.
And that, but that goes into their self-concept though, right? Those little dots that go into making their sense of self.
What do you mean?
Your example at the end where there's like the painter had all made all these paint, was it Van Gogh had painted all those things just using dots? And so we're just a collection of these different experiences. What did you call them? Oh, can't even think right now, but it's all goes into who people think that they are, and they think that experiences are real and they live with that. I mean, it's just part of their self-concept, right?
Right, so the self-concept can play a role in perpetuating that. Peter, do you want to say something?
Well, we're getting to the end of our time, but Satish has a question. If we can deal with it briefly, Satish.
Oh, what was it? Ellie, where did you get introduced to all these ideas?
What ideas?
Shared today?
What ideas?
That she shared today.
The presentation.
The course. Yeah. She said, of course.
Her presentation.
I'd say the Heart Sutra is the most concise.
Well, Ali, do you want to answer that? What sources were you using to build your talk around?
I thought you said you attended something.
Yes, of course.
Oh, the sources that I used to develop the talk?
Yes.
Yeah.
So a big recent source was a class that I actually took on dependent origination. It was a 6-week course led by a Dharma teacher, and he went into honing in, I mean, more than anything on dependent origination, but then also gave insight into how the aggregates play a role in that.
Aggregates.
I also listened to Dharma talks by Joseph Goldstein, specifically on the five aggregates. I did some reading online. And so I pulled from a bunch of different sources, but mostly the sources were just other Dharma teachers, whether listening on podcasts or in a course or articles written by Dharma teachers on the topic.
Yeah, I really liked your presentation. It was very clear and yeah, it's very well put together. Thank you.
I appreciate that. Thank you so much.
So we're at the end of our time tonight. Thank you for your participation, folks, and thank you for your clarity and your thoughtfulness, Allie. All right, it's our custom to sit together momentarily at the end of a sitting at our meeting, so let's do that. Thank you for your practice. Wish you well, and I hope that we're all reasonably safe and happy till the next time we have a chance to talk.
Thank you, Ali. That was good.